on overturning of everybody's rights. And here we are with Roe overturned, abortion is inaccessible in so many states. And I can see a similar pattern with trans care, where we have Alabama that's passed a law, we have Arkansas now, we have courts deciding what can and can't happen. At the end of the day, we know that this care is safe. We know that, and I say this as a physician who provides this care, who's trained in providing this care, this trans care is life-saving. It reduces people's ability, it reduces people's suicidality, it saves people's lives. It's important to have people be able to access this care, especially minors. And what we're seeing with the opposition is that they're targeting folks in southern states and targeting the most vulnerable among us. In this case, it's children. And so, again, this is another issue that's very closely linked to anti-abortion movements, where folks that support anti-abortion laws also support these anti-trans laws. At the end of the day, for me as a physician, these decisions should be left between me, my patients. We should use science and medicine and counsel our patients on what's best for them and let them decide what they want to do with their lives and their bodies and uphold their dignity and humanity.
And I'd like to bring Mini Tamaraju back into the conversation. The recent decision, I think it was on Wednesday, by a federal judge in Idaho, blocking portions of a trigger ban on abortions. Could you talk about that?
Sure. In Idaho, the Department of Justice brought suit on the provision, on EMTALA, the emergency care provision piece. And look, in Idaho, the court did say, look, the ban is still in place, which is deeply problematic, but a good step is that now, if a patient, again, has to prove it, and the doctor has to prove it, so it's not ideal, but if a patient can prove that they have an emergency, they can have access in an emergency room to abortion care. For all the reasons Dr. Kumar just laid out, this is still very problematic, but it's an important first step, because this is an example of how the Biden administration is taking a strong stance for reproductive freedom and reproductive rights and trying to use all the tools in their toolbox, particularly the DOJ, to intervene in some of these most problematic cases.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. There's so much to talk about, and we will continue to. Mini Tamaraju is president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. She's speaking to us from Philadelphia. And Dr. Bhavik Kumar is the medical director of primary and trans care at Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast in Houston. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a people and culture manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting...
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself on the move.
Hello, and you are listening to EcoJustice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. EcoJustice Radio acknowledges that we record the show on the traditional territory of the Tongva and all of their relatives. Welcome. I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, Lost Children of Turtle Island, the impact of Indian boarding schools, I will be interviewing Sunrose Ironshell, and Manape Lamer, government representative of the Sioux Nation of Indians. Manape Lamer has relinquished his U.S. citizenship and is a government representative of the Sioux Nation of Indians and a UN Economic Social Council committee member of the United Nations. Manape is currently working to rebuild all social and economic development for his nation and provide a proactive approach in response to genocide and 150 years of economic sanctions. Sunrose Ironshell is an artistic visionary dreamer. Hailing from the Missouri River Valley area in Sioux City, Iowa, Sunrose is Si Changu and Oglala Lakota Tituan Band of Osheti Shakowee, the Seven Council Fires, internationally known as the Sioux Nation of Indians. She is a cultural bearer and a high school teacher. She was featured in the documentary Women of the White Buffalo. You can catch her every Friday for Native News in 10 on Women of the White Buffalo Facebook page. The truth about the U.S. Indian boarding school policy has largely been written out of history books. Started in the 1800s across the United States and Canada, Indian boarding schools were government-funded and often church-run. The goal? Forced assimilation of Native children into white American society under the belief of, quote, kill the Indian, save the man, which still contributes to how we see and treat Indigenous people today. Sadly, the marked and unmarked graves of children have been found in the residential school systems of both Canada and the United States. The total is now over 6,500 Indigenous youth having died amid accusations of abuse and neglect. Our guest today will update us on the current situation and the history of this generational trauma and how bringing home the remains has become a way to tell the children's stories and hold to account these schools. Thank you for tuning in to Eco Justice Radio and our show, Lost Children of Turtle Island, The Impact of Indian Boarding Schools. I am your host, Jessica Aldridge, and it is my honor to welcome our guests, Sunrose Ironshell and Manape Lamer, government representative of the Sioux Nation of Indians. Welcome to Eco Justice Radio.
Oh, thank you.
Hello, thank you. Hello, everybody, and thank you for being in the climate action movement and protecting Mother Earth, and all you plastic fighters out there. I love it. Thank you. Keep it up. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. I love how this is starting. Well, welcome back to Eco Justice Radio. The last time you were here was early 2020, and that was for people that are listening that want to check out that interview. That's episode 51, Tribal Sovereignty and Self-Determination. And it's great to have you back. We're going to have a very interesting conversation, a very heartfelt conversation, and we're going to speak to the ongoing trauma of Indian boarding schools and missing and murdered children. And we'll also give an update on the rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline and discuss upholding what is the Indian Child Welfare Act to protect Native children, families, and tribal sovereignty. So before we get into all of this, I want to make sure that all of our listeners are on the same page and want to know that they understand what is meant by an Indian boarding school, and when was the first school introduced, and what was the quote-unquote purpose?
In my research, one of the first schools ever created was the Choctaw Academy around 1818 in Kentucky. And that ended up failing around the 1830s. And then later, you had some research that was done down at Fort Marion, just outside of St. Augustine, with some exiled warriors. Prisoners of war. And Lieutenant Pratt, he didn't see color. According to him, he didn't see color. And he felt that there could be some equity between Indians, blacks, and the white man. So they started researching, can Indians and freedmen, can they learn to assimilate? And some did well, about 17 of them did well. And they sent them up to Hampton Institute, which was one of the first schools to start educating freedmen after the Civil War. And from that research at the Hampton Institute, Pratt went for federal support and created the first federally funded Indian boarding school that was built to assimilate and acculturate Native Americans into what was becoming American culture.
And what was the age range of the students, and was their attendance at these schools voluntary, or was it mandated by the government in both in United States and Canada?
That's a great question, because I think that initially, like in Fort Marion in Florida, when you're an inmate, when you're a prisoner, anything's better than just sitting around all day. So I guess it was voluntary due to their circumstances. It'd be like a prisoner getting to work outside the fence and rake up leaves or something. But later with Carlisle, the age range, the first waves of Indians coming, which usually came from the Plains tribes, those were around 6 to 25 years old. And Pratt had the intention of, if you could get these children and start acculturating them to American society, the more successful that they would be. I think the premise of all this is that they're going to do us a favor, so to speak.
Going back to Fort Marion and the Cheyenne, the Kiowa warriors, Pratt wanted to assimilate them. That was the whole military mindset, to assimilate them, to teach them how to read, how to speak English well. Well, Pratt, he realized that you can't fill a cup that's already full. And he had that realization. And so he knew that he needed to take the children away, because their cup wouldn't be full. And then that's how he came up with the philosophy that you can kill the Indian and you can save the man. So if you take children away from their parents, away from their culture, away from everything they know, you can insert new culture and new family and a new way of life, which was the assimilated American life, which then we know turned out to be the next upcoming workforce, the next labor workforce. So a lot of the classes at the boarding schools were more industrial.
They actually occupied a former Carlisle barracks, which was a military compound. And when Lieutenant Pratt petitioned to the government for utilization of that land, he had to go to the War Department. And, you know, a few decades later, the War Department turned into the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is the federal entity that has supervision over us. Which I also have to remind people that these reservations that Indians are coming from are prisoner of war camps.
Yeah, and what happened too when the families didn't comply? So if they came to take the children to say they have to go to these Indian boarding schools, what if the family said, no, I'm not, my child's not going to go?
Yeah, so after the first wave of 6 to 25-year-olds, the next wave was anyone under 14. Anyone under 14 had to go, and each reservation had Indian agents that replaced their commissioners. And actually later, the first wave was Luther Standing Bear. He later became one of the commissioners of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So we have Deb Hollins and stuff now as a director, but back then he was the commissioner, and he was one of the first graduates from Carlisle Indian School. And he was also one of the Indian architects for the Indian Reorganization Act in 1935. But the consequence to this was usually the restriction of rations. And we do see some of those first waves of people, leaders that want something better for their, I'm using air quotes, better. They sent some of them willingly due to the circumstances. So it's willing, but it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't place to be. And maybe if we go, the philosophy was kind of like, maybe if they go learn some of that, we'll figure. I know they had this thing in the back of their head. We might be able to figure out how to beat them or survive this. So go learn. And they did. But some families were very resistant to that and very skeptical. And there was punishment of the withholding of food rations, which is promised by treaty. And you have wars that started, the Sioux Uprising in Minnesota that got a lot of people killed in places because of the government's breaking of the treaty by not providing those food rations.
The children also had to live at these schools, correct? So what was the process of rounding up the children and then transporting them to their destination? Because I would imagine they're not close to their reservations or their families.
Well, in the case of some Sichanggu children from Rosebud Reservation, we know that they traveled from the Prairie Central South Dakota, Rosebud, South Dakota, is still located there. The reservation is still located there. They traveled to Whetstone, which is on the edge of the Missouri River. Then they got on a riverboat, and they were sent down to Sioux City, and then they got on a train, and they went to Pennsylvania. So first you have the trip into unknown territory, away from your parents, but you're with a lot of other Indian children and other Indian children that speak your same language. Now, the parents, this was a big deal for us, for some of us, to send our kids to school. And I know when you send a kid off to school, your first day of school, you dress them in some first day of school clothing. So they dressed their children in some of the best moccasins, maybe the best beadwork, and they dressed their best to show up at Carlisle. But once they showed up at Carlisle, their clothes were immediately taken away. Their hair was cut. And the only time we cut our hair very short is in a sign of mourning. So right away, those children, what they already knew through with our religion and philosophy, is that we're in mourning and there has been a death. There's some type of death. And in that is the death of the Indian. Right along to back to Pratt's saying and his mission to kill the Indian. So already their first experiences at the boarding school was where a lot of their cultural literally got taken off of them, literally got cut from them and severed. And so you have this process of mourning and where you go into then your school uniform.
I even have heard from some families that have recently had their remains returned, and there was dialogue between the Indian commissioner, I guess the orientation people of Carlisle, and the parents back on the reservation. And they had mentioned that there was something that happened when you cut the hair of these Indians, and they don't know quite what it was, but it caused great resentment. And I think that the cutting of the hair was one of the catalysts for the continuation of the Indian spirit. And here in South Dakota, if you preserve that Indian spirit in any capacity, they would send you to a insane asylum in Canton, South Dakota. And that had operated until the 50s, 60s, something like that. But that either they'd find some way to suppress you. And so in the end, John Trudell says that, taking from him, he says that our drunks were our first protesters, at least in present sense, within the last 100 years, 100, 120 years, because they went to go learn white. They didn't like it. They didn't want it. They wanted to be Indian. And then, but they couldn't be Indian. And so they drank and were nothing until if they could survive this, you know. And so we have huge social gaps from that.
How many schools were they? I mean, there's the United States and Canada both had schools. Do we know how many schools potentially were in existence? And so people can get their bearings too. You know, where were some of these schools located? Because maybe people just think that they were in parts of Canada and the upper northern part of the United States. But how many, where?
You know, the school that I mentioned earlier, not the Howard Institute, but the Choctaw Academy, that closed down in 1830s. So this was even 40 years before Carlisle was even created. But those were more locally sourced for revenue. And eventually, all the Indians on the East Coast, all of them got shipped to what they called Indian territory, later taken away from them and occupied as Oklahoma. And then each reservation throughout the whole U.S., each reservation would kind of have their own. And some of them even had multiple, because what the U.S. government did was they paid good money to religious institutions to provide, whether it was Catholic or Episcopal or Lutheran and whatever, these religions would vie for these schools. And the farther out west you go, the less mainstream the religion is that's educating your children.
There were more than 350 government-funded and often church-run Indian boarding schools across the United States. Currently, as of 2020, the Bureau of Indian Education operates approximately 160 schools currently.
And I think that might be surprising for some people, because I think they probably think of this in a historical sense, that this doesn't exist anymore, where it does. Before we go to the break here, Sunrose, I wanted to go back to the comment that you said about the hair being cut. And, you know, some people argue that there was this quote unquote benefit to the tribes because these schools offered free resources and education. But as we know, some of the overall goals was to assimilate indigenous, basically break their spirit and remove them from their families and erase their culture. Those tactics that they use to erase their culture, to achieve this, to break the spirit, as you said before, one of them happens to be the cutting of hair. And there are others. So I wanted to know if you wanted to just speak to a couple of those tactics to make people aware of what they did.
A really big one was to kill the language. So these students came fully understanding their language, full as fluent speakers. And then they were told not to speak their language, that they could only speak English. Well, if you're a fluent speaker and you've never heard or you never really understood English, of course you're going to ask your friend what they said, what's going on. And every time that happened, they were punished. And in those punishments, they got more brutal and more brutal over time. I recently came across a story of an old man who was a survivor of the boarding school, who's still alive. And this is his current story. He realized that every time he spoke his language, his tongue hurt. It physically hurt his tongue to speak his language. Even though he was trying to remember it, he's trying to speak it again for the youth and trying to remember it. Well, he was around some other ladies that ended up, they were at the same boarding school and graduated with him. And she leaned over when the auntie said, do you remember when they used to stick needles in our tongue when we spoke our language? And right then and there, he had a realization of a memory that his brain, his mind had blocked that pain away, and he wasn't able to heal. So he didn't know why his tongue physically hurt every time he spoke the language until she said that story. And then he remembered. He's like, yep, I do remember that. They stuck needles in our tongue every time we spoke our language. So there's some brutal things that America and the United States does not want to look at, does not want to admit that they did. But when you're trying to kill a whole culture, you have to literally take violent moves.
Yeah, and we're going to go to break real quick, but I want to bring it back to this conversation and expand upon some of this, because you and I spoke previous to the show about how some of this just still continues on in our current education system. So I want to bring it right back. Everyone stay tuned, and yeah, stay tuned. We'll bring it right back.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying EcoJustice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to EcoJustice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Lost Children of Turtle Island, The Impact of Indian Boarding Schools, with host Jessica Aldridge, myself, and guest Sunrose Ironshell, and Manape Lemaire, government representative of the Sioux Nation of Indians.
Sunrose, before we went to break, we were just talking about the different tactics that were used at the Indian boarding schools to break the spirit of the youth who were there, to erase culture. And you'd spoke about that one individual or many individuals had things stuck in their tongue to convince them not to speak their own language. You had mentioned previously about hair being cut, but this idea, not even idea, but this thing of hair being cut is still happening today, not just with Indigenous youth, but youth across the board. So what is your message to people who are listening and to the educators that are out there? Because we hear these stories of people's hair being cut.
Well, first of all, I would like to give the viewers a little challenge, because there are some really awesome photos. There's some photography And remember, this was all an experiment and a research project to see how well they could kill the Indian and save the man. So they would take pictures of the children when they showed up in their Indian gear with all their finest elements, their hair braided. And then they would take pictures 6 months later of those same students. So you can physically look at a side-by-side photo of the Indian student in their full regalia looking like the way they identify, the way we self-identify, and how we come. And then the next photo will be their hair cut short in the school uniform, haircut short, school uniform, looking very drag. I mean, I would say I don't feel a lot of happiness in those photos. And then imagine your hair being cut, you're in the pants, you're in white colonizer clothes when you come home, and the rest of your people are still dressed like that. There is a stark contrast of, oh, they have cut hair, they're not down. And as an Indian person today, you can kind of feel that. That's still there, that like division with our own people because of that boarding school and coming home and looking in front and seeing a whole different changed person. They were like, yep, we're having this realization of, wow, my son went Indian and came back as a white man. You look white, you speak white, I don't understand you. And so there's this division. So now that trickles over to today, where we try to instill that when we let our kids' hair grow long, because those students back there couldn't and they were forced to have short hair. So now we want to bring our culture back. We want to bring new life into it. So we let our kids' hair grow long. But then there's a whole real reality. There's this crazy reality where that still exists. And it's 2021, and people should be allowed to self-identify however they are in America. We're supposed to be this melting pot of cultures, this salad. And there are cultures out there who come with their full regalia still. And yet we are here in the United States trying to bring our long hair back, and it'll still get cut off. Just recently, there were some news stories where this actually happened, and there are some lawsuits as of 2019 where teachers have cut Native American students' hair without their children's permission, or without the parents' permission. So that still happens. Teachers, educators, anybody out there, that is not okay. There's educators out there who still think that's okay, that you can go ahead and take those initiatives to cut their hair. But it's not okay.
It's not okay. And lately in the media as well, with the Indian boarding schools, we keep hearing consistent breaking stories revealing yet another discovery of Indigenous students' bodies found buried in and around these schools. And some are in marked graves, and then some are in unmarked graves. Is there a current count for the United States and Canada for these schools that are being found? And you know, also why the graves? Why so many deaths? Why, what is happening?
If somebody out there were to ever like try to Google that information, you'll find estimates between 1300, 1500. Those are all fairly recent. But, you know, when you get on social media, you're involved in these communities, those numbers start getting higher and higher. And I wish we had a more reliable understanding of what those numbers look like. Now, recently we had the repatriation. I prefer to use the term rematriation because it's Mother Earth, not Father Earth. I think repatriation is from the colonial construct of feudal systems. The rematriation of remains from Carlisle just a couple months ago had come through, and they stayed here in Sioux City, and we knew we had to do something. And so we hosted them and we cooked up, and the community came together and we acknowledged those remains. There was 9 of them that came through. And then we also acknowledged survivors of present day boarding schools. And we even actually had my nephew sing the flag song, which doesn't acknowledge the American flag. It acknowledges the Eagle staff and the war bonnet that our leaders wear. So it felt really good to have little guy sing that for these generations that probably didn't even get to hear that song maybe. there is a big difference, and that was something that I had to explain. It's a very emotional topic, so people can just read the headlines and go from there, you know. But as we researched and discussed with the elders and the children, Indian children that initiated the homecoming of these remains. But later, when they were on their way home, we had a chance to talk to some of the leadership that facilitated that return. We talked with those elders, and they informed us that Carlisle Indian School had initiated some of these talks of rematriating the remains, and that those children were in specific marked graves. And if you were to go to Carlisle, one of the first graves you would come to, and in that first row, they were all Chichangu, and there was an Alaskan Native, and they returned all those remains. And the War Department, the Department of Army, actually helped facilitate the exhumation and how they were going to return them with the elders. So that's different than in Canada, where they're discovering unmarked. There's still more research where they have to dig down and take a look, you know, but according to technology that's being utilized, radar technology, LADAR, I think, or something like that, utilizing that technology, they're able to determine a lot of unmarked graves. And that would make sense to me, because the amount of suicides that happen at these boarding schools, and growing up Catholic myself and being an altar boy and things like that, I remember it. This is what sparked from this meeting with these kids, with the remains. The idea that sparked in my head, I remember a kid, his father committed suicide, and they were devout. They went twice a week, Catholics. And I was an altar boy, and I remember asking the father, when's their funeral? Because some time had gone by. And they said, you know, well, they already had the funeral, but we wouldn't have been able to do it. We didn't do it. They didn't do it here. And I was like, wow, why not? I didn't know. And the reason why is the Catholics and other religions will not at all say any prayer over any suicide. And they won't even facilitate if your spouse is Episcopal. They can't do a funeral for your Episcopal wife, or they have boundaries. It made me wonder, what happened to these kids that committed suicide? How were they treated? Not just the ones that died of sickness or broken heart, things like that, but those suicides really interested me. And then are they suicides? There's some cynicism that really starts to creep in. More and more cynicism. And our people are very cynical. That is a little bit about the difference between what's taking place here in the U.S. with residential schools and the ones in Canada. It's almost Canada's being caught with blood on their hands. Unmarked graves. They didn't even have the decency to document it. At least the United States documented their genocide, you know. Yeah.
And you talked about the Carlisle Indian Industrial School and the Indigenous youth that are leaning on the effort for rematriation of these bodies and to bring them back. There was a ceremony that was conducted by the Carlisle School. So can you talk about the ceremony of rematriation that was conducted by the school, and then how that compared to the ceremony that the Rosebud Sioux did to honor the returned youth?
I'll field the first part of that. Out there, the Department of Army facilitated the funding. And then when the remains were exhumed, I believe the tribe had sent some buffalo robes over there, and then they took those remains and opened them up and put them in those buffalo robes, and then they put them in boxes. It weren't long coffin-like boxes. These were 2.5 by 2.5. They were square, very square boxes, and just pine boxes. They had a ceremony where the Department of Interior, the director of the Department of Interior, Deb Howland, was there. A lot of people were there. You had Army people. You had flags up. And at a particular point, the part of their ceremony of that rematriation was they ended up folding the flags up like veterans, because it was a military school and they were in the possession of the United States government. And so they ended up putting those flags on the on those pine boxes. And then when they came through, I had a discussion with some of the leadership, and they said, yeah, as soon as we got them boxes and loaded them up in the vehicle, we took them flags and kind of, you know, you didn't disrespect them, but we put them off to the side, and we put our own prayer flags on there.
no longer required.
Yeah, no longer required. Thank you. Right. I kind of wonder what happened to those flags in the ceremony later, or what people think about that. I think that would be a very interesting discussion with any descendants that were given those flags. But then after that, they had their own ceremony upon the arrival at Whetstone Landing, which is where they caught the riverboat, either to Sioux City or Omaha, but they caught the trains south along the Missouri River, and they were on their way. But Whetstone Landing is where they had another arrival ceremony. And then from there, they went to farther, deeper into the reservation for the funeral.
Before they stopped at Whetstone Landing, we ourselves hosted them. We reached out to those Sichangu Youth Council, and we saw their agenda of them spending the night here in Sioux City. Now, this would be considered the outskirts or the edge of Sioux Nation territory. So they were literally coming back to the horizon of their nation, their country, their homeland. Once they cross that river, they're back in their Titiwan territory. And so we got together and we got some buffalo meat together. We got some corn soup. We did some traditional foods, some ceremony foods, some corn wasna, the buffalo, the water, the choke cherries. And we laid out 9 bowls to represent those 9 spirits coming home. I'm really proud of Manape as being an organizer, because within a week, was it 2 weeks? Within a very short period of time,
it was about a week.
He was able to call the surrounding Indian community to come together, put a meal together. We had a teepee. We put our teepee up for the first time, and we were able to actually host and really act like a Lakota couple.
Nah.
And we had our buffalo robe, and we had the Sioux City staff that the Indians have been carrying in this community, and we welcomed our children home. And then in the morning, they left from the Sioux City Convention Center, the Tyson Convention Center, and they had a motorcade of motorcycles. They were really, really loud. Everybody was wearing orange. So that's where you get the hashtag Orange Shirt Day. And to wear orange, that color is representing those youth. Once the motorcade left the convention center, they had a police escort, and a lot of people followed all the way from Sioux City to Whetstone. Bikers, but then there was automobiles that stretched for several miles. I think I heard like 20 miles, the car stretched back. And then they arrived all at Whetstone, and then they had that ceremony, and then they went to Rosebud. And in Rosebud, at their college, university, big multi-purpose building, they had their wake, they had their funeral. Each student, each body had a funeral teepee. They also had historical references of who their families were, pictures of those students held up, pictures of those written letters from the Carlisle School to their parents. They had that whole history kind of out there for everyone to see. And then the ceremony was really beautiful. There was a lot of people that came together. It was really powerful and emotional. And it's almost right on time. You know, the Canadian students and their unmarked graves kind of gave us the microphone. And then this other initiative with these Rosebud students. So they got a lot of respect. And in that, a lot of people are coming out and saying that they are survivors. So all these truths, the truth will always stand tall, especially when you document it.
Thank you. We're going to take a break here in a moment. We're going to come back and talk about, you know, what is happening with the National Day of Remembrance and what's happening at the federal level with the United States and Secretary Deb Haaland, which you had mentioned a moment ago. So everyone stay tuned. We'll bring this conversation right back.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying EcoJustice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to EcoJustice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Lost Children of Turtle Island, The Impact of Indian Boarding Schools, with host Jessica Aldridge, myself, and guest Sunrose Ironshell, and Manape Lemaire, government representative of the Sioux Nation of Indians.
September 30th is the National Day of Remembrance for Indian Boarding Schools taking place in the United States and Canada. And the purpose of this is to acknowledge the ongoing trauma of the federal boarding school policies so that they can be rectified and held to account. I want us to speak to what is happening at the federal level in the United States, and then also what others can do, Indigenous peoples and the community at large. So let's start with the United States. Secretary Deb Haaland, she leads the U.S. Department of Interior. She is the first Indigenous American to serve as a cabinet secretary. She announced a federal Indian boarding school initiative, which will serve as this investigation about the loss of human life and the lasting consequences of residential Indian boarding schools. What are they looking to investigate and achieve? And is there any possibility, legal possibility, of a criminal investigation on part of the federal government?
You know, when I heard about this initiative from Deb Haaland, you know, I was happy to hear that. I was happy to hear that, being the first Native American director of the Interior, that she has the power to call for those sort of things. But then the next thing, I was thinking about that, and I was like, well, these churches are sovereign nations. That's why they don't have to pay property taxes and such. That's why non-natives can get away with paying taxes if they make their home a church or some sort of spiritual or a religious entity. That'd be the biggest thing, is like, if you're going to investigate, we already know. We already know what happened there. And, you know, if women are getting raped in these schools when they're kids, if Nazis can get thrown in court way down the road, how come the priests and the nuns and the teachers can't? That don't make sense to me. I'm aware of that. I see those things. The question is, as to what power and capacity does Deb Haaland have with the Department of Justice to move on that, especially when you have sovereign property like these churches have?
Because remember, the boarding schools were basically contracted out to religious institutions. So they were funded by the government and said, okay, here you go, set up this school. But then the way churches always act is turning into sovereignty, that sovereign position. So then, for example, the St. Francis Indian School, the St. Francis Mission Boarding School in St. Francis, South Dakota, in Rosebud, that land is strictly owned by the archdiocese. So the mission part of it, the whole school part of it, now just in recent years, they've given part of that land back. So the school belongs to the tribe now, but there's still a church, a mission, and there's a museum that's still owned by the archdiocese.
So if they do these investigations, is there any conversation around what happens after that? Is there any form of reparations? Like, what is the purpose of the investigation?
I think that's to see what sort of atrocities did happen. What do we got documented? What was there? Was there further atrocities? If somebody wrote home and said, if the superintendent of the school wrote home and said, your kid's dying of tuberculosis, but really he hung himself, or maybe the superintendent killed him, you know? And so we have a lot of testimony from elders and such about those sort of things. And you know, to be honest with you, it's frustrating because some of those boarding schools still exist, not in that capacity, not in that blatant capacity, but the mentality of it still exists. And then that also segues into ICWA cases present day. And then in 1978, we got the Indian Child Welfare Act initiated, and then we also got the Religious Freedom Act initiated. So you're talking Carlisle in 1879, 100 years later, we finally stopped the state from stealing our children. The feds quit stealing the children. And then families were sending their kids to boarding school because they were assimilated at boarding school. So I'm sending my kids to boarding school. Some parents utilize that time productively, some not so productively. But regardless, I'm sending my kid to boarding school. They're going. And at least my generation, I just turned 43. So I know a lot of kids that went to boarding schools. But it wasn't like back in the day. And when you're talking 100 years after Carlisle, and we finally get our religious freedom back, we finally get some accountability to the state on the exportation of our children from families, that's a long time, and we're only 43 years from that. As long as I've been alive, I was born in 1978. And so these protections have only been around for as long as I've been alive, and I think it's going to take another generation to start weaning off of the mentality of that.
So, like me, for example, I'm here. I'm in 2021. I'm in my 30s. I was born in a time where our freedom of religion is there. So I was born going to ceremonies, going to this. So I have a hope and a dream for my people. And I know where we can get. I know where we're supposed to be. I know what that community looks like. So when I turn around and I talk to my elders, or say I'll talk to administration at the school, and I'm like, oh, we need to do this because we know this system does not work for our students. We got to blow up this whole school system, and we got to recreate our own school system. And I talked about this in the previous episode. Where is there a place of learning for our children, our nations to go to re-root ourselves in our culture? That's what these institutions should be now. That's what, there's a lot of real pretty words out there of what we can be. But when somebody like me works in a institution of learning and I'm trying to implement some new curriculum, the other staff, these elders, these people who've been through the boarding schools will turn around and tell me no, because that mentality, that thinking, and I say that fear, that say the Indian has been beaten down to our knees, and we're on our knees, and nobody really knows how to stand back up. So they turn around and they tell us, don't stand up, because you're just going to get shoved back down. And we see it. We see it happening.
They say can't. You can't do this. You can't do that. So I call them Native Americans instead of Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And my question that I propose to all these Native Americans is, when can we? Tell me when. There has to be a goal. And they can't answer that. So to me, you're in the way. That's my own people. In the way. And you're going to have to get out of the way, because the next generation after me, how many kids do you think I can affect in my life? God willing, how many children could I tell these things that I'm sharing with you? How many children can I influence to stand up and rise up? Food sovereignty, our own education. We've toured Hebrew schools. We've toured Jewish schools. And we wonder, well, they're doing it. How the hell? Why the hell are we?
They get to eat kosher meals. I want to feed my people buffalo, elk, salmon, these beautiful meals, just like that.
What's the Indian equivalent of being kosher? And, then they even have prayer time in. Then they do all that in the morning, and then in the afternoon they'll go learn science and math and English and all the stuff that you're. But the whole morning is cultural. And the schools we went to once a year, or throughout a child's high school years, they can go to the homelands in Israel and learn. They get to go for a trip to Israel and learn over there. And then over there in Israel, they got people over in Israel coming over here. They got keyboards with the Hebrew language on them. They got whole libraries of Hebrew. And the Indian people here are barely getting books on the bookshelf at Barnes & Noble. These are the lenses that I kind of see things, and that's why I say maybe it's going to take one more generation of kids for us to really grasp some solutions and really encourage them to go ahead and stand up. And we've seen that with Standing Rock. We've seen that with the rematriation of these remains. So the youth are rising.
Sunrose, you are a poet, and on our last show, you shared some of your pieces. I would be honored if you would do that again. And the topic today is obviously a very heavy one. And I think your piece in regards to bringing back one's spirit and the healing that is necessary would be very appropriate for the space and the energy that we have here today. Would you mind sharing?
Yes, I'd love to share. So in our indigenous philosophies and our mindset, we have what is calling back your spirit. And everybody needs to get grounded. And so what we do, if we go on travel really far and we come back, sometimes we call out our names 4 times and we get regrounded in who we are and we can face the day again. So when we bring up all these traumatic events, there's a lot of healing that needs to happen. And I feel that at a young age, our indigenous people's spirit was left, right? And that's what they tried to do. Kill the Indian and save the man. So our spirit is still out there from that trauma, and we need to bring it back. So this poem is called Bringing Back That Spirit. So we're going to sing and we're going to dance. We're going to bring your spirit back. We're going to paint ourselves and comb our hair. We're going to prepare. We're going to make a ceremony to take back our Buchoni. They're going to sing a song that heals. We're going to call upon the Most High. The ancestors are going to come through like the wings of a magpie, bringing vibrations from before creation. They're going to give you back your voice, and you're going to rise up. You're going to get up off your knees, and you're going to stand like you've never stood before. So we're going to sing, and we're going to dance. And we're going to bring your spirit back. The ancestors are near, and the stars are going to appear. They may have eaten your spirit, but you're going to call out your voice. You're going to sing out your name for times to reclaim, and your spirit's going to come racing back. It's going to soar back to your body, and you'll fall down. But this healing will make you whole again, and the earth is going to take you to a different time frame. See, the dirt is going to cover up your scars and make you whole again. So you're going to stand like you've never stood before. You're going to break the habit that kept you sleeping, and you'll break those chains that have always kept you weeping. Because you've been walking with your head held down. You forgot how to be proud. You've left a gap in the circle, and we've been waiting for you to come back around, for you to unbury yourself from the ground, for you to truly be unbound. So you've been out on your own, and now you feel very alone. You used to be down to walk that mile, but now you've thrown out all your dreams, taking yourself out of that family scene. You let your words become vicious and mean. You didn't always used to be like this. You used to sing and dance. It was you who helped us call our spirit back. So we're going to sing, and yes, we're going to dance. We're going to bring your spirit back. You're going to wear a new shirt, become defender so nobody gets hurt. You've earned your place in the hoop. Arrow to the target. It is you who will never fall back. There's no more retreat in your feet and no tire in that attack. And now you're going to stand like you've never stood before.
Uh-huh. That was beautiful. Thank you so much. Sunrose, you are also featured in a film, and that's called The Woman of the White Buffalo. Can you tell us about that film and why people should check it out, and where and when will it be available?
Women of the White Buffalo, the feature documentary film, was shot in 2012 as a series of Lakota women, or women from the Sioux Nation, the Ocheti Shakoin, on how we are surviving through our traumas. So there are some stories of women who age from, I think she was 12, to our Unchi Marie Randall, who lived to be 101, and just various stages of our life and how we're doing. So there's a teenager, there's the 20-year-old, the 30-year-old, the 40-year-old, the 50-year-old, and we each talk about the dynamics in our life and how, you know, the United States government, in so many words, has created a platform where we just sprung up, and here we are. But we've come from historical traumas that have kept us in a box, put us in this little cubicle where we can't breathe, where we're going missing and murdered, you know, 10 times the national average as an Indigenous woman, I'm at risk to be stolen. So does that mean I should leave by myself and go on these trips by myself if it's 10 times more likely? And these are the realities that we're facing. So the film talks about our stories of our just simple reality and living as Lakota women, and how are we striving through that? How are we trying to make a change? How has the system changed us? And so there's the trailer out on the Women of the White Buffalo film.com, and it goes into a lot of more details on each individual women's story. And that was filmed by Deborah Anderson.
And is the film out?
It is available. It came out in April. It is available on Vudu, Amazon, Google, and iTunes, and YouTube. YouTube has a rental as well. But you're going to want to download it, share it with your friends, write some notes, and start the conversation.
Well, before we wrap here, our last question. So the people can find you, that they can follow your work, they can follow what you're doing, Sunrose, with the media drop.
How you can reach out and follow me is through Women of the White Buffalo Film. They've really taken in the initiative to let me hold that narrative and be a part of that camera. And it's been one of my biggest platforms. I do still post on my personal pages, and a lot of that is like happy birthdays to my man and, you know, family stuff. But my, when I really talk about social issues, is on Women of the White Buffalo Instagram page and the social media film. But my Instagram page, I like posting all my artwork, is at Living Warrior Status, LIVEN Warrior Status.
Manape, how do they find you?
Well, I don't really do Instagram too much, but I just kind of stick with Facebook. You can find me at Manape Lemire. And lately I've been working with a few different groups, a lot of social justice stuff around Sioux City. But I tell you what, our friends and relatives over at Great Plains Action Society is doing a lot of great stuff. There's a lot of energy there and really good perspective. And they operate out of the territory around here and throughout the occupied place of Iowa. They call Iowa. And then also we have our march that's coming up on what we call Thanksgiving. The United States calls Thanksgiving. The day before Thanksgiving, we have the 19th annual march to honor children lost in the system. And my father, really, before he passed away a couple of years ago, he wanted to make sure that 50 years from now, our children, those generations, can look back and say we fought for them. And so since he's crossed over to the Milky Way, part of us moving back to Sioux City is for me to help continue that legacy. I don't like to say that I'm going to fill his shoes or his moccasins, but I got my own moccasins to fill, but there is some overlap. So you can find the March for Lost Children out of Sioux City, Iowa on Facebook. And we're also working with the Urban Indian Center out of Sioux City. We are looking to build. We got a lot of things that we need to do. There's a lot of growth that needs to happen, and I think we're kind of behind. We don't have a very strong media presence. We're working on some of the social building of our community and strengthening and unity. But we do have wonderful allies within the city administration, and we're going to be pursuing the occupation and the rematriation of a park that is actually a cemetery for some of our ancestors. So that's some of the stuff you got the names.
Definitely follow us at Great Plains Action Society. We both are contributors to that page and share a lot of posts and do a lot of actions through them. And also my artistry, I'm trying, folks, to get out there as artists. So I'm working on my website, and that is soon to come. I'll have a website release with a lot of new artwork and maybe a fashion new release as well. So look out for that.
That's great. And we're going to put some of those resources in our blog. And for those of you listening on the radio right now, be sure to check out the podcast. This conversation goes a bit longer. We're continuing the conversation. So there's a longer version that we're going to put on our podcast. Please check it out. And you can always go get that podcast at ecojusticeradio.org. And thank you to both of you, to Sunrose, to Manape, and a special thanks to Auntie Lydia Ponce for always bringing us together.
Love you, Lydia.
The godmother of Venice Beach.
Love you, Lydia. And thank you to our listeners and to both of you. Thanks so much for being on the show. We greatly appreciate you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you to our guests, Sunrose Ironshell and Manape Lemaire, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. This has been Lost Children of Turtle Island, The Impact of Indian Boarding Schools. Remember, go and check out part two of this episode where we continue the conversation with our guests. Please go to ecojusticeradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And also, please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, you know what to do. Subscribe to our podcast, share the episodes, get that shared knowledge out there. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. The show can be found on all major podcast apps and at ecojusticeradio.org. Created by Mark and JP Morris, executive producer Jack Eit, producer and host Jessica Aldridge, engineer Blake Lampkin, and original music by Javier Cadre. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.